You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, June 2nd, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Jeff Madrick, contributed to the New York Review of Books, among other things, author of The Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America. We'll also be talking to independent journalist Ryan Gallagher, I promise you, today from Britain on Los Indignados, happening in Spain, protests. Folks, just a reminder, many of you listen to this program. Thousands upon thousands of you listen to this program on a daily basis for free. If you can become a member, I would encourage you to the fullest extent of encouragement. Yes? Please, we need your membership. Support this program. 50 cents a day. Not only do you get the 40-some-odd plus minutes that you already get, you get another 40 minutes where we talk news, where we talk, where I get a little more personal. I give you updates on my life, my travails, my triumphs, my failures, and my failures. So please, if you can become a member, please do at majority.fm. Yesterday I mentioned this hunger strike that was taking place in Minneapolis. After 12 days, the group of, well, I've heard 6 to 10 people now, including a Reverend Grant Stevenson, who were taking nothing but water and a little lemon juice, have ended their strike without having any real resolution to the wages that they're earning. But they did attract the attention of U.S. Representative Keith Ellison. They attracted the attention of the Minneapolis City Council, and they felt that at the very least they got some coverage of their plight, and so they have ended their hunger strike. And I don't know if it's going to change anything, but it made us aware of their plight, and hopefully others, and hopefully they collected something like $100,000 worth of receipts from people who went to those Cub Foods grocery stores. Hopefully this will exert some measure of pressure on that company to increase wages. Meanwhile, Chris Christie still under the gun for taking this helicopter ride to his kid's baseball game, then taking it jetting back in the helicopter, as it were, for a fundraising dinner with people who want him to run for president in Iowa. I mean, for God's sakes. Apparently it cost about $2,500 an hour. They had to have a state car take him the 100 yards from the baseball game to where he had parked his helicopter. How long would that have taken him to walk there? God forbid he exerts some calories. And apparently, this is a practice that has been controversial by governors in the past. However, apparently, the When a helicopter was used by Christy Whitman, she repaid the state. When the helicopter was used by former Governor Jim McGreevy, he repaid the state. And Ritz-Carlton Christie refuses to repay the state. I guess the Star-Ledger refers to the helicopter as Sanctimonious One, the taxpayer-funded helicopter. We've got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jeff Madrick. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. A real pleasure to welcome to the program Jeff Madrick, author of Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, among other books and contributions to other media publications. Thank you so much for taking the time today, Jeff.
My pleasure. The title also says 1970 to the present. I just wanted to point out.
Well, let's we'll get to that because this is a... I guess in the annals of American history, a relatively recent phenomenon, not so much greed, but the triumph of greed and finance. Let's start with the question. What is finance supposed to do? What is the financial industry supposed to do for a country, for a society? And what has it become in
right.
a sense?
Good question. The primary thing it is supposed to do is allocate the nation's savings to the nation's business, to productive investment. Some of it low-risk investment, low-risk business loans to keep companies going, the old thing the commercial banks used to do. Some of it riskier ventures, new ideas, new expansions, new companies through equity, stock, and other new kinds of securities. Of course, secondarily, it provides a way for much of America to invest in business in America, and that's no small matter. We can invest our money, but that has to be a fair investment and a control, and in my view, regulated kind of investment.
So
what's
so-
happened is we've misallocated this capital. And I know you're going to get to that. We've been misallocating this capital since the 1970s.
All right. So, I mean, so finance is a crucial industry for any type of growing or functioning society. But we have this misallocation now. And what is that a function of?
Well, I think that's a function, and I trace this in a book. It's always hard to write a longish book and then capsulize it very quickly. But I trace it to what was basically an assault on government in the 1970s that was victorious. It changed the attitudes of much of America towards the purpose of government. It made much of America want to limit government and allowed much of America to condone a deep, philosophical, profound deregulation of the financial business. And that began in the 1970s, not in the 1990s or the 2000s. Finance is not like selling autos or selling chewing gum. It is a very special kind of product subject to all kinds of whim, manipulation, and speculation. And it requires close government regulation and oversight, not to take the finance industry away from the private sector, but to control it. And we learned to do that in the 1930s because of the devastation of the Depression. And because of this change of attitudes and then the focus of business and finance in particular on gaining political power, those regulations got rolled back either in letter or in spirit. We didn't create new regulations, for example, for changing times.
Now, I have financiers. I mean, my understanding was that bankers and financiers, they weren't always so rich, I guess. I mean, you'd go in, a banker was, you know, back in the day considered as fairly, boring, straight-laced profession, and there was money, but there wasn't the sort of enormous amount of wealth generated, was it?
Right. Well, exactly. That's a very good point. One of the interesting moments in economic history is when J.P. Morgan died. He was the great financier, as you know, of the late 1800s and early 1900s. In fact, there's never been anybody like him again. But when he died, Andrew Carnegie, I believe it was, said, "My gosh, I didn't know he was so poor." Wall Street people did not make nearly what the industrial owners of industry made back then. That all changed, and that's partly why the thesis of this book is that individuals were responsible for what happened. It was not some great, inevitable, historical force that created our problems. They were individuals, and I tell the story in terms of individuals. And it's a complex story, but I think when you tell it in terms of individuals, a very readable one. People began to get very rich by taking advantage of ever-loosening regulations. And this led to bad decision-making, loans to third-world countries, which were crazy, takeovers of companies, which were crazy, at crazy prices that resulted in a lot of pressure on cutting jobs and even R&D, but made billionaires of leveraged buyout specialists and takeover specialists, crazy investments by savings and loan institutions that were deregulated in one of the most, forgive this word, but one of the most idiotic pieces of legislation in 1982 America ever produced. And in the 1990s, we all remember the high technology fantasies. We would sit around and say, these are fantasies, and it would go on and on. Why? In large part, not in small part, in large part, because Wall Street people were making so much money issuing securities to launch these companies at high prices for which they'd make 5 or 7% that day of that take, and on to the housing craziness of the 2000s. Misallocation of our precious capital, which could have gone into productive investment that could have built the foundation of the country, all coupled with very low tax rates, you know, very low tax rates.
And that, I presume, also freed up a lot of sort of almost extraneous capital for which to drive these type of transactions.
I think so. You know, if you have a very low capital gains rate, why not just keep speculating? Why not keep investing this money for the short run and you know, make these big gains, especially if you have a little knowledge about what's going on or a little, you know, you're tied to a group that might know what's going on. And in particular, in the early 2000s, you can borrow, if you're a big company, at very low rates, leverage up your equity, just like we all do with a home. You know, we put 10% up for a home. And when that home price goes up, you know, we're making a big return on our investment. Well, these guys did this in silver, gold, international currencies, international and federal, you know, government bonds and so forth. And what a circus. What a circus it's been. But I think by and large it damaged America. Could I say why it damaged America?
Yes.
Mean, you know, the answer to this, Alan Greenspan, who is one of the frankly, and I don't like to make personal attacks, but I avoid that in this book. I try to be dispassionate in this book and tell it as it is. But Greenspan does come across as one of the main villains of the time. Alan Greenspan would have said, well, we had to allow this wild over-speculation and these bad investments in order to get the good investments. But over this period, productivity, output per hour of work, which drives living standards, did not rise at historically rapid rates. Capital investment was strong only in a few years of this 40-year period, strong by historical standards. And wages, as we know, have stagnated. And for men, they're actually lower today. The typical man today makes less than the typical man did after inflation in 1969. So the benefits did not flow. The argument is bogus.
I've also read, and I believe it was in Jared Diamond's Collapse, that the great societies of the past have essentially collapsed when finance hit a certain percentage, I believe it was in the upper 20 percentage points of the economy. And is that simply a function of the fact that there's so much wealth that is being misallocated, that is in some way been taken out of the real economy and created almost a secondary economy, which is creating a tremendous imbalance within a society?
I believe there's some truth to that. I don't believe there's enough empirical information to say there is a specific cutoff point in societies when, you know, we go over the top. I do believe America went over the top. There are two ways of looking at it. One way is almost a Marxist way of looking at it. The economies run out of good investments, so they make these crazy financial investments, games people play with each other. The way I look at it is somewhat different. People played games with each other, not because we ran out of possible productive investment in the economy, but because it was so much easier to make a lot of money in finance. You didn't have to take the risk and undertake the long-term unknowns of regular investment, the way capitalism should really work. It's just easier, especially if you could cheat. And there was a heck of a lot of cheating and lying and manipulation and inside information over these 40 years.
And so, you know, your book does focus intensely on individuals like Walter Wriston and Boesky and Greenspan. And I think it shows that this was not this is not a natural phenomena. I mean, it takes individuals, but on some level, there has to be a context, and the enablers who have allowed this to happen. And when we think about the reason why we organize as a society, why we have governments, is to ensure on some level that we do have allocation of resources that benefits the most amount of people possible. And
right.
And so what can we do? Where was the context? Where were the enablers? Where was that problematic? And what can we do to sort of to fix this?
Well, I think the enablers, frankly, we have to blame ourselves to some degree. This belief that government is not necessary unless proven necessary. This belief that overcame the nation. Now, partly that occurred because some people were so effective at controlling the economic debate in Washington. But partly, and I try to explain this, these are the complex events of history. Partly it came out of the very difficult times in the 1970s with both soaring unemployment and soaring inflation. And people needed a scapegoat. Government became that scapegoat. And everybody climbed aboard, including the Democrats. And pretty soon, deregulation and weaker government became the order of the day. I teach kids still believe that. They say, why should government get in the way of private markets? Even after this devastation we had, it became deeply ingrained in us, and people took advantage, and leadership did. Nobody effectively rose, or few people effectively rose to counteract that. And I think President Obama has not been sufficiently effective. People always say, why don't we get the reforms we got after the Depression or during the Depression, the level of reform? And I say one reason is we avoided that Depression because of the lessons we learned. We avoided the severity of it. So people are not so scarred and hurt, although they are very scarred and hurt. But secondly, we don't have FDR. Individuals make a difference. Mm-hmm. FDR took on the battle, took on the fight, and told it like it was. And he made mistakes. But basically, he was willing to do battle and be a leader. I think if I have one message for people, and if this book has one message, and it's a book of stories. I mean, history is a story, and I try to make it a narrative that I think is an accurate one. Americans should not sit back and think we're just going to muddle through and be okay. Nations don't necessarily wind up okay. We've got to start taking responsibility for this mess much more seriously.
And I know you have to go. I have one final question, because one thing that strikes me over this 30-year period, and particularly in the last 20, is this notion of money and greed almost as an ascendant value in our society. Do you think that this was a function of the tremendous wealth that was generated in the hands of a few, and it created a sense that money became more relevant in people's lives, more important to accrue, more of a status symbol, vice versa.
Yeah, I think that by and large we became a culture of money. We can't, you know, I can't imagine, who could have ever imagined that people would get on television and claim our problem is that teachers make too much money, as they've been doing during the recent raucous in Wisconsin and elsewhere. It is just unbelievable, abusing teachers. Teachers, there may be some requirement for reform there, but the idea of saying, and I get people who say, oh, but those bankers created jobs. Hmm. Wrong. Those bankers lost 8 million jobs a couple of years ago, 8 million to 11 million, and we haven't gotten them back yet. So we've really got to wake up here. A capitalist free market system is great, but it is only one sphere of an economy and a social system. There is another sphere, the cooperation government sphere, and they've got to work together. In the last 30 to 40 years, this competition business free market sphere has pushed out and denigrated the idea of cooperation. And the societies that are going to succeed in this century are the societies that understand the value of cooperation and mix it with the value of business and the great creativity and energy that business can release.
Jeff Madrick, thanks so much for joining us. The book is The Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the present. We will have a link to that book on Amazon at majority.fm. Thank you so much for taking the time today. It's a great read, and it's an incredibly, I think it's the paramount issue of our day.
Thank you for reading it, Sam, and thank you for inviting me.
We've got to take a break, folks. We'll be right back after this brief pause. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a packed day. We'll be talking to Ryan Gallagher in several minutes. Update on things in Fukushima, and love to hear from some of our expat Japanese listeners on this. The Bloomberg reports, I guess this morning, that radioactive water accumulating in Japan's crippled Fukushima plant may start overflowing from service trenches within 5 days, potentially increasing the contamination from the worst nuclear crisis since Chernobyl. I think I mentioned yesterday in the post show that the amount of radiation that they're seeing now outside of the 12-mile evacuation zone is already reached the levels in which they had within the 25-mile zone of Chernobyl. It is a bad situation there. Yesterday, I mentioned that they have now essentially removed all of the workers from this plant who are under the age of 60 and brought in older workers on what I think in its most crass way can only be described as essentially a suicide mission. These older workers are basically saying that if I contract cancer, I won't have as many years to live with it, I guess, as it were. I mean, it's just a horrible situation there. You have 60% of Japanese adults worried they've been contaminated since Fukushima. The poll shows that at least 80% of the population is dissatisfied with the response from TEPCO, I'll say. It's a horrible tragedy that continues on. We don't hear much about it. I imagine that's because one of our major networks is at least owned within 49% of its shares by one of the designers. The designer of the Fukushima plant, of course, I'm talking about GE, but We all know how this works. The meanwhile, in a story that I know will warm Jimmy Reefer Cake's heart, at least is being reported at this point, I think it's fairly obvious to everyone, well, not everyone, but I would imagine most of the listeners of this program, that the global war on drugs has failed. This is going to be a report issued today by the commission, the Global Commission on Drug Policy. The report is calling for a frank dialogue. In other words, grow up, everybody. Grow up. Encourages governments to experiment with the regulation of drugs, especially marijuana. The 19-member commission includes a broad spectrum, former UN Secretary Kofi Annan, NATO Secretary General Javier Solana, Paul Volcker, former Secretary of State George Shultz. Our minimum goal is to get the U.S. to discuss the problem in all its magnitude and not lock itself up in a policy that has failed, says Mr. Gavira. He is Cesar Gavira of Colombia. Mexico and Colombia must get the U.S. to debate. The belief that there is no alternative because of electoral reasons is not acceptable. Spokesman for the White House's Office of National Drug Policy Control said U.S. drug policy wasn't a result of a drug war mentality.
I don't think so.
And that its balanced drug control efforts are making a big difference. Including recent reductions in drugs such as cocaine. There's an ebb and flow, right? I mean, sometimes cocaine is popular, sometimes it's crack is popular, sometimes it's heroin, sometimes it's pot. It's all just a function of the price and how available it is. People aren't doing as much cocaine because there's so much meth. Making drugs more available, the report suggests, will make it harder to keep our communities healthy and safe, says spokesman Rafael Lamatier. In the report, Mr. Gavira blasted the impact of U.S.-led anti-drug efforts on already hard-pressed state institutions like police and courts in countries throughout Latin America. Guatemala last month declared martial law in the jungle province of Pitan after gunmen believed to be members of Mexico's brutal Zetas cartel. And I should say, if you want to read some great reporting on the drug wars in Mexico, Google Guy Lawson, who visited us yesterday, and look at some of his reporting. It's amazing. It is incredibly disturbing. Apparently, this cartel beheaded 27 people. I don't know why this isn't on Fox 24 hours a day. Presumably, of course, this drug cartel, the Zetas, they're Muslims, because only Muslims do that. We know that. We know that now. We know that Muslim terrorists only do that. This would ruin the narrative, wouldn't it? If we found out that, oh, actually, people behead people all around the world. In this case, they're doing it because we've empowered them by militarizing this entire drug war. What we've managed to do is create, essentially, militaries. Paramilitary groups around the world, particularly in Latin America, who exist only because they have the ability to sell drugs on the black market, because we have created a black market. In Mexico, more than 40,000 people have died in drug-related violence over the past 5 years. Actually, 4.5 years. 40,000 people. We're winning! We're winning, man. I remember when I was in high school, a bag of pot. We never talked about like grams or ounces. It was a dime bag because it cost you $10, from what I understand. And that bag of pot was, I'm trying to find some example of what it looks like. It was like, I don't see anything in this room. It was big. It was about half the size, maybe like a third the size of like one of those sandwich baggies. Yeah, Evan's eyes just like bulged, like, oh, God, good old days. And we called a dime bag. Now, my understanding is you get a couple of grams for $60. I had to do a lot of research for that. One bright note, at least. Eric Holder on Wednesday, in speaking to the U.S. Sentencing Commission, referencing the Fair Sentencing Act, which was signed into law last August, which eased the disparity between crack cocaine violations and cocaine violations. Because, you know, crack is for poor people, cocaine is for rich people, and so we should be able to put the poor people in prison. Maybe you could talk about it in terms of white and black. But this was created in the 1980s in response to rising violence and drug addiction rates in urban areas. He says that basically we should retroactively diminish the sentences of people who are in prison for these hyperinflated crack violations. 12,040 offenders sentenced between October 1st in 1991 and September 30th, 2010. The idea that someone's been in prison for 20 years for using crack, or frankly, selling crack, is stunning. They would be eligible to seek reduced sentences, according to the Sentencing Commission report. About one-third of the group would be eligible for release if approved by November 1st, 2012. The average sentence would be reduced from 164 months to 127 months. You kill somebody, and you're in jail for 5 or 6 years. Parole, 7 years, maybe. Unbelievable. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, hopefully we'll be talking to Ryan Gallagher on what's been happening in Spain. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Suter on the Majority Report on the telephone, as it were. Ryan Gallagher, he is an independent journalist. He has been covering the protests in Spain for the New Statesman. He writes at Open Democracy, contributor to the Guardian newspaper. You can check out his website at rjgallagher.co.uk. We'll have a link at majority.fm. Welcome to the program, Ryan.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
So tell me what's going on in Spain. We've had incredibly little reporting on what's happening in Spain and, for the most part, what's happening across Europe in terms of people protesting, I guess, a combination of austerity. Well, you tell me, what was happening in Spain? What did you see, and why are folks out there?
Well, I mean, you're right. It's about the austerity measures. It's about high unemployment. There are between 4 and 5 million people in Spain just now who are unemployed. A lot of young graduates who've graduated from university, and there's basically no opportunities for these people. So they're very angry about that. And that's the essence of it. That's why they're out in the streets, you know. That's why they've taken to the streets, and it's why it's taken off the way it has, because there's so many of them. There's so many of them in Spain.
Now, is this a give me a sense of how atypical or typical this might be in terms of protests these size, and give me a sense of the size of the protest.
Well, it's actually the thing about Spain is interesting because a lot of the coverage here as well hasn't been that great in the UK as I think you're saying it is in America. And when people do talk about it here, they've only really been talking about it in the sense that it's a thing that's happened in Madrid and also in Barcelona. But actually, I mean, over the course of the last couple of weeks since the 15th of May, there were these protests taking place in more than in 60 of the cities in Madrid. In fact, at one point, I'd heard over 100 towns and cities in Spain, but certainly over 60 key cities. So it's across the country. So that maybe gives you an idea of the scale of it. But in Madrid, in the main square in Madrid, there were, I think at its peak, it's always hard with estimates, but between, I think, you could be safe to say between about 25 to sort of 30 odd thousand people were in that square when it was sort of at its peak, and they're still there just now. They're actually still there as they are in Barcelona, the two main ones. And in fact, the one in Barcelona has grown in the last few days because there were, I don't know if you've seen, but scenes of horrendous violence on the streets of Barcelona because the police went in to try and clear people out. And they literally were just attacking people. It really was the videos actually speak for themselves. It was just blatant sort of police brutality, and it was really, really hard to watch actually. But that's inflamed the protest further. So now there are actually more people out in Barcelona because that sort of that triggered more anger and more protests. So yeah.
Now, is your sense of what is your sense of who's actually making up these protests? I mean, one of the as we've seen, you know, whether it was in Madison, Wisconsin, it was whether, you know, and I don't know to what extent we can lump this in, but maybe to a certain extent, even in the Middle East, we're seeing a broad cross section of people who are protesting a fairly broad agenda that isn't limited, like we may have seen, like rates being raised at a university or specific cuts to one specific group. We're seeing a broad cross section of people. Was that your sense as well? What you saw on the ground in Spain?
Oh yeah, very much. That's actually one of the most striking things that I noticed about it was that there are. You know, they've built in Madrid where I was, they've got like a children's nursery. So there's, you know, there's babies there, there's families, there's older people. I spoke to a 66-year-old man who I quoted in one of the pieces that I wrote, and he talked about it in the context of Paris in 1968 and the sort of real sort of feeling of revolution back then and when people came out into the streets. And he's seen it in the same context, and he actually told me that he thought this was more significant, this was bigger, because it isn't just Europe, it isn't just Paris, this is happening across the world, and it is, you're right, I think, it's part of the same narrative that you've seen even in Wisconsin or in the Arab world, in Tunisia and Egypt, Syria, Yemen, it's all the same, it's part of the same sense that things just aren't right. And although the narrative is clearly different in somewhere like Egypt, where you have a dictatorship and you have tyrants who are in power and who've really oppressed people viciously, it's still about this longing for a real democracy. And that's what they talk about in Spain, real democracy. They feel that they don't have real democracy. They feel that there's this corruption among the politicians, and there's the bank bailouts that people are very angry about in this country as well. There's just a sense of injustice at the core of it. And that's definitely something that exists whether you're in Wisconsin or in London or in Paris or in Madrid or in Tunisia. There's this sense of injustice, and that's why I think, and people, they take inspiration. So the people in Spain talk about the people in Tahrir Square in Egypt, they seen that, and they said to me, well, that it taught us that we could do it, that we seen them and we didn't have the fear anymore. We realized we could do it because they'd done it, and they were facing, you know, a military dictator that they were opposing. So they had more to lose in a sense by going out into the streets of people in Egypt, because there's a history there of, and you know, horrendous police brutality. Not just getting hit across the back by a baton, but actually, you know, taken and imprisoned and never seen again. So they had more to lose. And I think when people in Spain seen that, that they thought, well, you know, why on earth are we not doing the same thing? Why are we not going out in the street? And so that's kind of, that's another one of the factors that sort of culminated in what we're seeing now, I think.
And so what happens next in Spain? I mean, I think to a certain extent, I read that what was happening in Spain also sort of encouraged people in Greece. And you had 100,000 people turn out in the Capitol building in Greece as well. So what happens next? I mean, how do they? Is there a sense that the planners, that the organizers in Spain have a plan to maintain the energy and the protest, or is this something that just dribbles out? What's your sense of what happens next?
Well, that's the big question. I mean, because things like this, they do and historically have, you know, just sort of disintegrated eventually, because people have to go back to, you know, they can't just stay out in the streets forever. They can't do that. There are practical reasons why they can't do that. So I think that for them, keeping the momentum is going to be the main, it's going to be the main sort of struggle for them to keep that going. They certainly do have a plan. They're constantly putting together these proposals. They have debates every day, and they have these big general assemblies where they all get together and discuss things, and they have quite a clear agenda. I mean, they're not just there because they're angry. That's quite important to stress, that they're actually there and they have this clear agenda. It's like a sort of manifesto almost, and they want basically, at the core of it, they want a referendum, they want electoral reform. They think that basically they've got a sort of two-party system in Spain, as they do in the States as well, but they feel that neither of the parties represent them. They feel that they're both bad eggs, they're both corrupt, and they've both done things that no one's really happy with. And so their idea is that to resolve that is electoral reform. And so they have this agenda, and they're trying to spread these sort of little camps around Spain so that people everywhere else around Spain can also have the same discussions, form proposals. And then I suppose in a way they will themselves, it's almost logical to think that maybe they will have to form their own sort of political party. They're already a movement, they're not a party. But for them to actually affect change in a real and proper way, it's almost as if they will themselves have to become a political party. And I'm not quite sure if they would want to do that. But it seems to me that that's the only real, you know, maybe in a sense realistic way that they could do it without some sort of, you know, actual serious violent revolution where they go in and just overthrow people. I mean, that's not really what they want to do. They'd rather just reform it, you know. So in a way, maybe the evolution of this will have to be that they're going to have to form their own sort of political party. I don't know. I think that might be what happens.
Ryan Gallagher reporting from the UK. His reporting on Spain can be found in The New Statesman. Writes at Open Democracy, and you can check out his site at rjgallagher.co.uk. Thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks, we've got to take a break and head to the post show. You can IM me at majority.fm. Tomorrow on the program, my interview with Bobby Kennedy on mountaintop mining. Cliff Schechter will be here. I don't know if Chris Rosen's going to be here. We should have done a poll today. Call in to the show. Or the number 646-257-3920. I got to figure out how to deal with this Chris Rosen thing. I've sort of blocked it out of my mind for the week. But we've got to figure out a solution to it. Next week on the program, I'm holding in my hand, or just outside the reach of my outstretched hand, Sarah Vowell's Unfamiliar Fishes. She'll be joining us next week on the program to talk about her latest book. She's one of my favorite. I think she's my favorite historian. She's the only historian I know who's actually fun. All right, folks. Got a whole stack of news here. We'll talk about it in the post-show. Talk to you tomorrow. Oh, and don't forget, if you can buy some crap through Amazon, buy the crap through Amazon through our link at majority.fm. You should never make an Amazon purchase without going through majority.fm. It costs you nothing. It could actually save you. People buy computers. They buy TVs. My dad bought a small rototiller. He bought it through Amazon. He called me the other day. He's like, this is great. I actually made my garden rows so that the rototiller will fit through. I'm not going to have to do any weeding this year. There's all sorts of crap you can buy through there. And we get a tiny kickback, but every little bit helps. And, of course, go to justcoffee.coop. Put the coupon code MAJORITY in there. Get a 10% discount off your coffee, tea, or chocolate. Talk to you tomorrow or on the flip side.